Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Romanovs.
I'm Olga Romanov.
Michael Romanov.
He said he was a Romanov?
You know, she's a Romanov.
Checking in for a Romanov.
I'm Romanov. I'm so tired of this Romanov shit.
Nicholas Romanov.
I could be a Romanov.
He's a Romanov too.
Hello and welcome to the final episode of Still Watching the Romanovs. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Thank you guys so much for your patience. We know that this episode is a bit delayed. We had some holidays and some traveling and all sorts of stuff got in our way, but we are finally here to talk about the season or possibly series, I don't know, finale of The Romanovs titled The One That Holds Everything, directed by Matthew Weiner and written by Donald Joe and Matthew Weiner. And then we also wanted to, because this is our last still watching episode of the year, we wanted to take a look back at some of the shows that we covered this year and just sort of, you know, reassess the whole experience, the year in still watching, if you will. So we're going to open up with a little Romanovs and then close out with a little tour of some TV highlights for us this year. Richard, I think we were, there was a little bit of trepidation on our part, I think, in terms of talking about this episode, which I should say stars Hugh Skinner as character named Simon Burrows, Ben Miles as his terrible father, George Burrows, and JJ Field, who we saw in a previous episode as character named Jack, and Harry Hilmar as Ondine. And this is a sort of, rushing nesting doll of an episode, if you will, because we get like several buried sort of flashback narratives told by different characters to piece together the whole story of the character of Simon, who winds up not being Simon in the end, or not being named Simon in the end, I should say. So, Richard, broad thoughts on this episode.
Well, this was a funny one because, well, you mentioned that we had holidays and stuff. I was actually in your state, California, with my family for Thanksgiving. And, so I ended up watching this episode with my family. My mom, dad, my sister, and her fiance. And, so it's funny to watch it sort of with other people for the first time because I haven't done that with really anything else we've talked about on this whole show this whole year. So kind of brought an interesting perspective. They were like, oh, that was so entertaining. And, we also had watched the Catherine Hahn episode just before that and they loved that. And on second watch, that really is so good. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, let's dive into the next one. And it's obviously so different in tone from the penultimate episode. And I was like, oh, that was kind of good. And then I thought about it and I was like, wait. And then like problem after problem started to, sort of pop out in my mind as I thought back on the episode. Particularly as it pertains to, I'm assuming we don't have to issue a spoiler alert, but just in case.
Yeah.
As it pertains to, Simon, becoming, sort of realizing that she's a transgender woman, changing her name to Candace, as played by Adele Anderson, and that trope or that, well, real lived experience for many people, being used as a trope and as a device, that has kind of long plagued, the queer community and, trans people, this sort of violent murder, revenge-y kind of thing. And I was like, oh, maybe that's a really bad episode and a very weird one to end on.
Yeah. Cause we had talked, last time we talked about the Catherine Hahn episode, End of the Line, we were like, that was such a good episode. Why aren't they ending with that? Why, what is going to be in this next episode that, you know, is going to feel like a more appropriate capper for the season. And maybe it is a more appropriate capper because it's just like, it's by turns engrossing and entertaining and, like in some parts emotionally affecting and then also deeply problematic, which I think is just sort of the whole season of the Romanoffs, if I want to be honest. But yeah, you know, we should mention Adele Anderson plays character of Candace, who we meet on the train. And yeah, I guess it was silly of me to try to pussyfoot around any sort of spoilers, but like I was interested in it in this storyline until, you know, it was revealed that this character was like a vengeful murderess. And in that instance, I do like maybe people aren't aware of that as a trope for both like gay and trans characters in certain kinds of fictions and films. But, you know, that is a very damaging stereotype that has existed in stories. And so when I saw it playing out, I was like, oh no, like what? This, you know, the conversation that you and I think had off air is like, once again, much like I think the Andrew Rannells episode of earlier this season, it feels like if one other person had watched this or read the script, or why didn't someone read the script and raise this as an issue, you know?
Yeah. And the thing about it that, you know, always comes up when we're talking about this particular issue or anyone's talking about this particular issue is, not that, you know, people of differing sexual orientation or gender identity can't be villains and things. Of course they can be. And, you know, right. They should be able to play or and be embodied in whatever, you know, character that one can imagine. It's just kind of when it's used as the hook, as when it's used as the twist, you know, especially with trans people where like, oh, you know, like you think about The Crying Game or something where it's like, or Sleepaway Camp where it's like, here's the big reveal. That feels cheap and exploitative. You know, I think something like, again, this is about a cis man, white man, but like Talented Miss Ripley, that's a story about a queer murderer that I think is beautiful and actually gets at the heart of something, sort of dark and interesting about queer identity. So it's a tricky road to haul. And I think that like this episode would be so much richer without that nasty little twist at the end.
Particularly because the vengeance is like such a nasty kind of vengeance because it's not vengeance on Dean, who is someone who has, you know, plagued him his whole life, but on this character of Jack, who we met in a previous episode, and so is someone that like we consider and who seems throughout the episode relatively sympathetic. Like, the episode starts with him helping like a woman struggling with her luggage and her small child. So this is a nice fellow. But maybe that's kind of the point, is like he's a nice guy because he has had the luxury of being brought up as like a pampered prince in his family and not cast out the way that his brother was.
Right. Well, you think about, you know, the Bolsheviks killing the Tsar's children.
Yeah.
And, you know, is that to imply that this guy is somehow complicit in his family's legacy of exploitation and whatnot, like the Tsar children were? I don't know. You know, it's a tricky topic. And it does fold into that the sort of broader themes of the show, interestingly, in that way. But then who is Candace in that equation? You know, right. I don't know. So it all feels a bit muddied just to kind of get this little thing in there. And in a sense, to spoil what had been a reasonably measured conversation about trans identity earlier in the episode.
For myself, I quite liked that conversation. And like, I'll admit as a, you know, cis woman that I don't have all the insights into what feels like the right and wrong way to talk about trans identity. But that conversation in which, you know, Hugh Skinner, Simon in the midst sort of figuring out that he is she and is Candace, has a conversation about like what it means and is it as part of this group. And I actually kind of liked that reveal too, because like, let me backtrack for a second and say I watched this episode in two parts because the episodes are so long. I think I got interrupted in the middle and had to walk away. And as I walked away, I was like, I'm pretty sure that the scene partner on the train that's a trans woman. That's a trans woman actress. So I was like, because I had the time away from the episode to think about it, I was like, I'm pretty sure there's going to be some kind of like trans twist, which I'm apprehensive about. But then I got to the like sort of self-help group or however, therapy group, however you want to call it. And I thought that was reveal was so interesting because it's a camera pan around looking at like shoes and you just don't, and like the way that they've styled Simon in that scene, you know, just on his way to her is, you know, I thought it was kind of interesting. And Hugh Skinner is a performer that I really respond to and have done in like Fleabag and Mamma Mia 2 and other things. And so, you know, I wanted to be there with this episode and I'm really sad that the ending landed the way that it did, you know.
Well, yeah, I think that because of the sort of time jumping and the way that it shows, the sort of dawn of Candace and her identity, like, it's not, in an admirable way, I guess, it's not linked to any event that we see. It's not like, oh, this guy rejected Simon and just sent him on this tailspin into gender dysphoria. You know, like, they are not linking those causally at all, which right. I think is good. And so to then, yeah, to kind of, you know, muck it up at the end. And also I think that I liked the kind of Inception era, like bumps back and back deeper and deeper into the story, you know?
Me too. Yeah.
Like I like that layering device. I thought that was really, well done. And it gave the story such a sense of, well, time and depth the way that, you know, you think about the OA where that was such a storytelling exercise and, or even The Haunting of Hill House in a sense where you keep moving back and back. And I think that, you know, getting to the root of something, I like that a lot. And I thought it was rich with emotion with this poor kid and that actor was great. And it just, yeah, it did not, stick the landing, so to speak. Which, you know, is not to dismiss the work of Adele Anderson, who I think is great. And, you know, just with a minor tweak here or there, I think this story, even of revenge and reprisal, comes off okay. But in this instance, it didn't.
Yeah. And I mean, there are ways in which, you know, if you don't know how the plot's going to unfurl going in, you see the way in which this character is rejected, you know, as Hugh Skinner plays the character, is rejected by family before you necessarily know exactly why. Because it's, you know, what you get a sense of is that, you know, his dad, George, as played by Ben Miles, who once again is an actor I quite like, and the Undine character, both like could sense in Simon, who becomes Candace or is Candace all along, this gender identity and like rejects the kid because of that, you know, and that's just something that I think you, or at least for me, only becomes clear once you go like three steps back in this like weird nesting storyline, which I quite like. I liked the, like the romance as it played out, in, it's China, right? Like where he is. I'm sorry. It's been a little while since I watched the episode.
I believe he's in Hong Kong.
Oh, in Hong Kong. Yeah. And, I liked that whole sequence a lot too. So I don't know. It's just, it's tricky. It's hard to fault a lot of the performers. Except I would say Hera Hilmar is Undine. That might not be her fault though, because Undine is such like a, like, just unbelievably villainous creature that it's, that I think it would be hard to pull off that, you know, performance and make that person feel, real. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think also like the stuff about fantasies or about like the wicked stepmom or all that stuff, like,
yeah,
that's gendered too. It's a little played out. Maybe that was the point to kind of, you know, work with those sort of old tropes and just figure out what, you know, to figure out a new thing to do with them. But I don't know. I think in a broader sense, you know, just going back to how we started this conversation and in particularly in rewatching, The End of the Line, why, I mean, it really should have ended on that episode.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that this episode maybe shouldn't have been included. I mean, I would, you know, prefer it if they had changed it some, but like thematically, when we step back and look at the whole of this weird, expensive project, everything I think of real value that the show and Weiner is trying to say is contained not in the episode called The One That Holds Everything,
right,
but in the other one. So yeah. I don't know.
That's interesting. All right. So is there anything else you want to say about like the Romanovs as a whole or this episode particularly before we kind of take a further step back?
I would just say that, you know, I think for the purposes of our podcast, I mean, I don't know, we can let the listeners into like the sort of sausage factory aspect of it. But like this, I think, did not lend itself well to as well to this format than like Westworld or Sharp Objects did, you know, because like everything was so discreet that it felt hard to have a real through line.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting experiment, I think, on our part, certainly on Amazon's part. I walk away from the series not disliking it, certainly finding great fault in aspects of it, but for a few contained episodes, I enjoyed the experience.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
Yeah, we support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and I have to say that... and this happens sometimes when I do podcasting for TV, is that maybe I wouldn't have finished the season were it not for this show. And that's not
true.
Like, yeah. That's not an expression of like deep dislike. It's just sort of, there's so much going on. Each episode is so long, you know, all of that's, you know, all that's happening. And so, you know, we'll talk about some of the other shows that we covered, but I think that sometimes I am like enormously rewarded, not just by watching something once through with you, but maybe even twice through, and the depth of understanding I can get from doing that. So I'm glad we did it with the Romanovs, because it meant that I made it all the way to the penultimate episode, which is something I'm very glad that I watched. I'm not sure about the finale, but you know, I'm glad that we made it to the end of the line. So let's take a little tour back. Yeah, and we should say once again to sort of show you how the sausage gets made, we have to make these decisions about what we're going to cover, oftentimes sight unseen, almost always sight unseen. So we didn't know what the Romanovs was, and we didn't even know like the runtime of the episodes or that each episode would be quite so discreet from each other. So, you know, these are just choices we make on, you know, using the best of our knowledge in terms of, you know, the filmmakers involved and all that sort of thing. So let's hop one show back. I'm going to hop over the like fall miniseries that we did to the show that I think might have lent itself the best to this format, which was HBO's Sharp Objects. This is a show that I love the more that I think about it. And I think it was really enriched by the conversations that you and I had about it, the fact that it's based on a book so we could look at the source material, all of that. You know, with a few months away from it, Richard, what are your feelings on Sharp Objects?
Yeah, I mean, I think it worked well for this, and I certainly enjoyed it, and really, you know, what I really enjoyed about it, watching the show and in correlation to doing this podcast, was being forced in a sense to watch the episodes more than once, and in that really growing to deeply appreciate Jean-Marc Vallée's whole approach to the whole thing and his aesthetic and how really beautifully it synced up with the kind of story it was telling. You know, I think it's rare that you get such a sharp pairing of, well, no pun intended, of director and material when the director didn't write the material, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So I appreciated that. And, you know, everyone's so good on it. And, you know, it hasn't lingered with me in any sort of, I'm not haunted by the show, but probably be because I was approaching it more as work. But yeah, I think it was good for us. I mean, I think I had more fun with Westworld just because that was so many different, theories. And I get into that kind of mode. Well, I haven't for a long time, so not since Lost. So it was nice to kind of do that again.
Yeah.
That said, doing this with you, who's sort of the expert on this, like, I realized that how bad I am at predicting anything or like noticing little clues or Easter eggs. I'm just not good at it.
Well, I want to, yeah, let me, before we roll back to Westworld, which I'm excited to talk about again, I do want to say really quickly that, you know, you and I host another podcast, co-host another podcast called Little Gold Men, where we talk about award season.
Mm-hmm.
The Golden Globes are just about to be announced tomorrow as we're recording this. They'll probably already be out. The nominations will already be out by the time you guys are listening to this. But I was discussing a film that has been in the conversation for a while, sight unseen, which is Vice. I was talking to Todd Vanderwoof of Vox.com about Vice, and he's like maybe the only critic that I know that really likes that film. It's been pretty universally disliked, but in the conversation for so long around that film was Amy Adams, who plays Lynn Cheney to Christian Bale's Dick Cheney in this film, Vice, which will be out later this month in December. And, you know, whether or not this was her year, which we've heard over and over again with Amy Adams, who's a great performer, and it keeps like, you know, like Arrival was her year and she was on the campaign trail for Big Eyes, but maybe didn't want to be. Like, you know, it's just every year it seems like it's Amy Adams' year. When we were talking about Amy Adams, I was just like, I really need her to win something as much as awards mean anything for Sharp Objects, because I think that that is just a case of an actor throwing everything she has against the wall for a role. And whatever does and doesn't work in Sharp Objects, and in, you know, my opinion, most of it does, I think her performance is just something that we're really lucky to be able to watch. So.
Oh yeah. No, I totally endorse that. I mean, it's really, I think it's some of the best stuff she's ever done, you yeah. know, and to do it all at that intensity for that many hours, you know, it's not a 2-hour movie. It's long. And to be kind of in that headspace convincingly, and tirelessly, as she was. Yeah, I mean, hats off to her, and hopefully she'll be richly rewarded for, you know, in a way that the Academy just keeps failing to.
Yeah, and we should mention more, I don't know, but one other thing is that, you know, actors, when they're in like an awards buzzy show or give an awards buzzy performance like that, usually do so much campaigning. But Amy Adams has, I think, since the show came out, not done any press about it and did very little press beforehand. And, you know, the reason that she gave was because it was sort of like a really hard and traumatic performance for her, and she doesn't really want to revisit it. And I entirely believe her. And that, to me, speaks even a little bit more to her performance, that it really just genuinely did soak into her, and she doesn't want to, like, really go back there, and who can blame her? So, speaking of women in trauma, let's talk about Westworld. I agree with you, Richard, that that was maybe of all the shows that we did this year, no, definitely the most fun to do. Like, it was just really fun to talk to you and to talk to the fandom about this very like twisty theory friendly show and stuff like that. And I think it was the show that like our listeners had the most fun listening to. Cause I think just that kind of TV, mystery box TV for better or worse, is something that hooks people in a different way than, you know, a searing drama about self-harm and murder in the South.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you can obviously be funnier about it. You can make jokes like in a way that like, you don't want to make a joke about, you know, gay tragedy in Versace or whatever, you know. I think the funny thing about doing the podcast on Westworld was that, obviously I was thoroughly invested at the time, but I was recently trying to think of something. Oh, a song. It was a song that played in the series finale of Westworld season 2, or season finale, the Radiohead song. And I was trying to figure out which one it was. And so I went and like, found it, like, queued up on HBO Go, like the moment where I thought the song started playing, and it started playing, and I was like, oh wait, I have no idea what's happening. I do not remember at all. So I kind of went back and rewatched the last episode. This was like last week. And I was reminded of how busy and all this stuff was going on, but I really like, it's such a dense show that, even in doing a like thorough podcast about it, I still didn't retain stuff, which is amazing.
I think that's true for me as well in terms of Westworld. It's a show where, you know, the enjoyment of it lingers with me, the mood of it lingers with me, and certain things like, that like what we thought was like a Lost inspired cold open, or everything that Ben Barnes did. Like, certain things just really, really stick, but the really twisty reveal of things, especially in that finale, aren't like sticking with me. You know, and I don't know if that's a criticism of the show or of that kind of storytelling to begin with, but it's like, yeah, it's more like moods, like the Akichita episode, mm-hmm. that really sticks with me big time. Of course, I thought that was tremendous storytelling, but yeah, just like some of the like nitty gritty of like whose mind ball is inside what body at what point. I mean, that's just, I don't know. It's not something that my brain wants to hold on to.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also like, I think the mood thing, that's right. I certainly, you know, palpably feel and remember, you know, the sort of experience of watching the season, and certainly talking about it with you. But I'm also someone who watched probably 5 seasons of The Walking Dead and could name maybe 2 characters. You know, like, I just like certain particular details I just can't hold on to. But that doesn't mean I didn't like it at all. It just means that I was immersed in a different way.
Yeah. All right. And then we get to our last episode.
/first.
Our last show, which is the first that we ever talked about together, you and I alone on our own podcast. And that is The Assassination of Johnny Versace by that coward Robert – no, American Crime Story. And this is the one that I think has, like, aged the best for me over the year. And I think that's true for a lot of critics, actually. I've talked to a lot of critics who just, like, sort of – this show, I think, got – mixed positive, but mixed reviews when it first came out. And I think most critics that I've talked to by the end of the year are considering it like actually one of their favorites, or people who came to it later and maybe binged it also, I think, seem to really enjoy it more than people who maybe only watched like the first 4 episodes that came out on screeners or something like that. And you know, we're also like continually revisiting the show because Darren Criss is on this like sort of award season juggernaut train of like, surely, you know, won the Emmy, surely is going to win the Golden Globe, probably, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and I think as well, he should. So, what are your feelings on Versace now?
Yeah, I think it's like a work of ambition. It certainly, you know, that encompasses so much. Yeah, it's still, you know, is held in high esteem in from my position. I don't miss the experience of watching it though. Like, it was
fair,
such an exhausting thing to kind of just be in that headspace, watching episodes multiple times. You know, cause I had reviewed it earlier before we started the podcast. So I had to go back and watch it, you know, but no, I mean, I'm glad that people have come around on it. And I think people weren't really sure what to make of it at first because it didn't have quite the same hook as People versus OJ. But those who stuck with it, those who went back and revisited it, it does seem anecdotally have been, glad that they did and impressed by it, which, you know, I'm glad that, that it had some lasting power because there is so much, I mean, it's, you know, an offset thing these days, but there is just so much television that it's easy enough for something to be good and memorable, you know, while you're watching it, but it's hard for it to be memorable. You know, there are plenty of shows, you know, shows, one seasons of a show that I've watched, that I've really enjoyed at the time being, thought about for maybe couple days after, and then it's gone. So for something, granted, this is a huge thing with star power and produced by the biggest guy in television, whatever, but still for that to held on for the better part of a year, despite a kind of quiet debut, I think that's a testament to its value.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you, of course, that it was, yeah. Remember how we had to record an episode on Valentine's Day? Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
So, you know, I agree with you that the experience of watching and recording was, like, once again, not nearly any kind of fun the way that Westworld was. But you know, the mood that I talked about with Westworld, I would intensify even more with Versace. I get like a holistic mood from that thing. It's just like, it's of a piece in a way, you know, that I would say Sharp Objects definitely is. I think Westworld was kind of too erratic in, quality to be of a piece for me. But, I think Versace, the overall story that I was telling, the ambition of the rewind sort of idea, all of that has really, really stuck with me. And one thing I was glad to see, I quit American Horror Story, I don't know, a season and a half ago, probably something like that. But I guess Cody Fern was on American Horror Story Apocalypse this year, so that, you know, a ton of people watched that, way more than watched Versace. And loved him. Apparently he was amazing in it. I still haven't watched it, but apparently he was amazing in it. And playing, I believe, the Antichrist. And so that is really exciting to me, because I think if we came out of that with anything, it was like, you know, a hope for Darren Criss to be rewarded for the good work he did. For me, an elevated opinion of Max Greenfield, not just because of his performance, but because of the thoughtful way he talked about his performance, I found really, really arresting. And then a hope for enormous, bright future for Cody Fern. So.
Yeah. Speaking of the future, do we want to kind of preview 2019 that we actually have more mapped out than we did when we first started this project this year?
Yeah, even though HBO is not paying us, we will be a bit of an HBO podcast for a little while.
Well, the reason they're not paying us is because Joanna and I are orphans owned by HBO. We were left at the doorstep years ago.
Right. This is sort of like an indentured servitude.
Yeah. So we're not being paid, but we do work for them. No, we don't. But it just so happens that like the most still watching-y shows coming up next year happens to be three HBO shows.
Yep. So we are starting, you know, if all goes according to plan, this is something you think about over the next week, because we'll be next couple weeks, because we'll be back in 2019, starting with True Detective Season 3. And
which I know we've been burned on True Detective before, not you and I personally, but us as a TV watching collective. But we have faith about this one.
I think, you know, I was definitely burned by True Detective Season 2. And, you know, have certain amount of trepidation around any, Nick Pizzolatto join, if I'm being honest. But I think you and I would agree that, you know, the presence of Mahershala Ali as the lead in this, not to mention Stephen Dorff, who's I'm a big fan of, is enough to sort of draw us back in. So, and True Detective, when it's at its best, aka like the best of season one, is like Westworld, even though a little bit more, you know, grim, a fun theory show. Genuinely is.
Oh, yeah.
Season one was. So, you know.
Yeah, and season two was a strange, like, tone poem where I feel like every other page of the script got, like, blew away in the wind. And then they were like, I think this is the full script. Let's just film this as is. And it made no sense.
Right. Exactly. And then the most Vanity Fair show that I can think of comes next from HBO, which is Big Little Lies, season two, this time with Meryl Streep. So,
well, we just started talking about stopped talking about the bad second season of a lauded HBO show. So let's hope that this does not follow True Detective's example. How could it if Andrea Arnold is directing every episode?
Exactly.
I think that's so exciting. The Meryl Streep factor is, yes, exciting, but like we see her every year. We know what she can do. Andrea Arnold is a rare, creator. She made American, Honey and, Fish Tank and a number of other good movies. So, she's exciting. The thing I'm most excited about when we look ahead to Big Little Lies Part 2.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing because the first season was obviously based on the book by Leanne Moriarty. And then this one goes beyond. And, you know, it feels like a thing where when they announced the second season, I was like, but why though? Right? Because the first season feels so contained. That ending feels like such an ending. But then you mention Andrea Arnold and you mention Meryl Streep and I'm like, yeah, okay, all right, we'll see what you guys got to do. I mean, it's a great cast. No matter what, I hope it's just, I hope it's a fun, murdery jaunt back to Monterey. We'll see.
Yeah, and the interesting thing will be to see without Jean-Marc Vallée's very particular directorial stamp, what the whole tone and rhythm of the show is. It could be good, it could be bad, I don't know. I have, again, faith in Andrea Arnold, but we'll find out this late winter.
Yeah, one thing I will say is that perhaps the soundtrack won't be quite as interesting as it always is in a Jean-Marc Vallée joint. All right, last one. There's a show that I don't know if our listeners have heard of.
You've never seen it before.
No, so this will be my first. This will be my introduction to a little HBO show called Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Have you seen it, Richard?
Yeah, I do like 5 podcasts on it. Oh, wait, sorry, that's you. Okay. No, I have seen Game of Thrones before. I've seen every episode. I remain a wary fan, I would say. The show has lost me a bit since the book material went away.
Sure.
But just because, you know, how do you... You can't really recreate something that dense when you're working on a TV production schedule. And, you know, every episode would have to be 14 hours long if you wanted to really get into everything. So, you know, I think we're well past the shallow now in terms of George R. Martin's vision of this thing. So I'll be seeing, you know, and it's the end. So I have my theories, speaking of making theories, about how things are going to wind up, mostly because of, like, reading you and other people who know what they're talking about. But I think it'll be an interesting project because we're coming in so late in a show's run. And it just so happens to be the biggest show in the world, but for, you know, and the biggest since a long time ago, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. What year was it that you did this piece where you're like, everything that's ever happened on Game of Thrones? Do you remember that?
Oh gosh. I think that was in anticipation of the fourth season premiere.
No, so, really? That was like our first year at Vanity Fair, I think.
Quite a bit ago. Yeah.
Wow. All right. So, you know, you want to go back and read that. That was a really fun thing that Richard did. I want to say that was like you did it before season five, but maybe it was before season four.
I don't think I would have the capacity to remember four seasons of that show, but maybe. But like, is there something that you and I could do to like, help ourselves remember what's going on in Game of Thrones?
Man, I mean, I think we're gonna have to rewatch it all. That's what I think. So,
but not just rewatch. I mean, if we're just gonna rewatch it and not talk about it, what's the point of that? So, wait, are we gonna rewatch every episode and maybe do an episode of this podcast about each episode?
Oh, I don't know if we're gonna go that deep, but we will definitely be discussing some old episodes of Game of Thrones on the Still Watching feed. So keep your eye out for that in 2019. Speaking, I want to give our listeners like a little preview of a piece that I have going up on VF. It'll already be up by the time you guys hear this, but, speaking of like how it's kind of impossible to adapt George R. R. Martin, I was reading the script, his last script that he wrote, which is back in season four, and, which is, Prince Joffrey's wedding or King Joffrey's wedding and the death of Joffrey. That's the last.
The purple wedding.
The last script that George R. R. Martin wrote, and it's, his script is very different from what ended up on the screen. And one of the things that was just making me laugh and shake my head in affection and oh, George, is like his description of the feast, which is like 6 pages of script long. And Weiss and Benioff are basically like, yeah, no, we're not serving Swan and then Boar and then Pike and then whatever. So, yeah, we have a lot of affection for George, a lot of affection for the show when it's good, a lot of affection for, I have certain favorites. Do you have like a, sorry, quickly before we go, this is your holiday gift to me. Who are your top two favorite characters in Game of Thrones?
From the books and then until recently on the show, Sansa.
Uh-huh.
But I don't, there was a little detail when the dogs ate the guy where she kind of turned a little bit cruel that I didn't love. But I mean, that guy deserved it, but I didn't like her little smirk. But no, she remains someone I'm rooting for. And then, oh, you know, I suppose like I'm rooting for Podrick.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Who's yours? Who are yours?
Oh, I'm a Jaime fan.
Jaime's good.
And a Jorah fan, but that's show Jorah, not book Jorah. So those are my allegiances personally. So we will see.
I also the Reeds. Yeah. The Reeds, Jojen and... Well, yeah. one of them's dead, but...
Jojen. Like, Jojen of Love Actually fame. Love that kid. Mm-hmm. All right. So on that note, on the Love Actually note, we will say goodbye to you guys for the holidays. Wish you happy holidays. Thank you so much for listening to us all year, like, through the highs and the lows of television.
Yeah, no, it's like, I realize that these things are time commitments, both not just for us, but for you out there too. So we really appreciate it. We also, you know, appreciate your feedback, be it positive or negative. You're allowed to criticize us, certainly. We often deserve it. Not always, but often. And we hope that you'll stick with us in the new year. I know that some of these shows, we're kind of jumping around in genre, but that's kind of the fun of it. And if you're not a diehard Game of Thrones person, that's okay, because we're not, Joanna has like real diehard podcasts, and this is not going to be those. So.
Oh, no. Worry. This is going to be Joanna and Richard talk about how much they love XYZ of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
All right. So as Richard mentioned, we still have our email/Podrick Payne fan account, which is stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. where you can email us any of your thoughts over the holidays. Thank you so much for your emails about still watching, and also all of your tweets where you're like, where's that episode? Because it made me feel like people are actually listening to the Romanoff series, which I wasn't sure about. Until the new year, where can people find you, Richard?
I am going to be going on a murder spree all the way back to my hazy Midwestern hometown that happens to be in a theme park full of robots.
Oh man, you got it all. You left me nothing.
I'm also on Twitter. Where are you? You're coming with me. That's a surprise.
Yeah, surprise. I'll be getting on the train to Westworld Objects Versaceville with Richard. Richard's at Rylaws. I'm at Joe Wrote This. You can find us on Twitter. And we will see you all in 2019.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.